Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio241, and it is August 23rd. Let's see if I can lean up forward and not get feedback. August 23rd, and we're going to proceed with a chemistry chapter today. I know we've been looking at some things, looking at chemical bonds. Certainly, we'll finish chemical bonds today. So maybe in your mind, you should know how many types of chemical bonds are we going to talk about? Okay, there's actually four, okay? And you should know how to rank them in terms of strength of interaction. And you should know how these chemical bonds originate. It has to do with the electrons. What kind of electrons participate in chemical bonds?
Valence.
And that's just a fancy way of saying it's the electrons in the outermost shell. All right, and I think we were going to draw a water molecule on the board just to do this really fast. But what you see here on the slide, just to reiterate, these are the elements that you have to know for this particular class, not the whole periodic table, and what their chemical symbol is. And that tells you right here. So this is a list. Any of these I could possibly put on the test. You do not have to know the third column. It's just the first two columns right here. So if I write Na on the board, you know that stands for sodium, right? There's no correspondence. So you have to know Greek to understand why even in English we use Na, right? Don't be tricked because I doesn't stand for iron, it stands for iodine. And what stands for iron? Fe of all things, right? So there's a little memorization. All right, and what can you tell me? In a general term, since I don't have the periodic table for you to look at, but in a general sense, what's the difference? What makes oxygen different than carbon? The number of protons inside the nucleus, and we call that the what? The atomic number. All right, so if I go find this periodic table over here, all right, so this is what you're going to have available, and maybe I'll project it on the screen for you during the test, is the periodic table, and it gives you the element, and then it tells you what the atomic number is. And here it is, one. So hydrogen has how many protons?
One.
One, right? And helium has two. I don't think helium's on your list, but you know, this periodic table tells you everything, more than you need to know. How many protons does carbon have?
Six.
Six. That's right there, right? So you don't have to memorize that. You just have to know how to use the periodic table. Okay. The other thing is, you know, when we started filling these shells up with electrons, we said that the first shell will take how many electrons?
Two.
Two. And then the second shell or orbital will take eight. And you don't have to remember that either because that's on the periodic table because look at the number of elements you have in a row. So look at the first row. How many elements are in the first row? One, two. Hydrogen and helium. That just means that the first orbital has two electrons. Right? The next orbital, which is the second row, has what? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight electrons. So you don't have to memorize that either. Right, so this is just a nice little cheat sheet that will be available for you on the test. Okay, and then as we get higher up, more complicated, there are some more orbitals that form. When you get down to this fourth row over here, we get these class of orbitals. These are p orbitals. These are like my favorite orbitals, but we're not going to talk about them in this class at all. Okay, and they might be your favorite orbitals too when you start to study that. All right, so let's put this over here. Maybe I will use that later. Too bad you can't see it, but maybe you printed it out. If you printed it out for yourself, that could be handy for today's lecture. Okay, oh, some people had a question about Blackboard and not being able to access some of the information that's on the instructor website. The practice quizzes, there's a simple quiz, difficult quiz, and when you get to the initial page, like the index page for those quizzes, it asks you for a username and a password. And guess what? You don't need a username or password. All you have to do is click on the resources button on the top left-hand part of the page. Just click resources, and it will take you to all the chapters. Chapter 1 material, chapter 2, chapter 3. There's all kinds of other interactive exercises, but I've imported that into Blackboard for you, but not the quizzes. All right, so just hit resources. Maybe at the end of lecture today, if I have time to open up a browser, I can show you how to do that. Or after class, all right, I'll stick around if you have a question. All right, so let me put this periodic table back. Where is it? It's over here. All right, we were building a water molecule. We were talking about covalent bonds, which is the strongest kind of bond. And in your mind, you should be able to tell me what is a covalent bond? Maybe in just a couple key terms. What's happening to those valence electrons? They're being shared between atoms in a molecule. And when a bond is formed, you no longer have an atom. You have a molecule, because a molecule is just a bunch of atoms that are put together via chemical bonds. All right, so you all know the chemical symbol for water, which is? H2O. Ooh, what does that 2 stand for? That doesn't sound like anything that we looked at on this on that table we're looking at. Yeah, it just has 2 hydrogen atoms, right? H2, 2 hydrogen atoms. So that's just a chemical formula for this molecule right here. 2 of these atoms right there. So the center atom is oxygen. How many protons inside the oxygen atom? Hopefully you can see this marker. Go look at that periodic table. Do I see oxygen? Indeed I do. There's 8, so there's 8 protons. So when it's neutral, how many electrons does it have? 8, because protons and electrons exactly cancel each other out. That will make that electrically neutral. So in the first orbital, when you look at the periodic table right there, how many electrons in this first orbital? 2, because that's how many elements are in that first row. So we got 1 and 2. Then the next orbital, there can be as many as 8 to stabilize this oxygen right here. But of course, how many are left? There's 6, right? So we can say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. In order for oxygen to be very nice and stable, it is looking for 2 electrons from someplace. Who would like to share an electron with it? Hydrogen would love to, because hydrogen has 1 proton in the nucleus, 1 electron in its orbital, but it really wants to have 2. And it's willing to share the 1 that it has with oxygen so that it can get 1 from oxygen. And the same thing on the other side of this molecule over here. We've got a hydrogen with another electron right here. Ooh, what molecule did we just build based on orbital theory? Water, H2O. Okay? So now the number of protons in all of the nuclei are exactly equal to all of the electrons in these orbitals. So what's the overall charge of a water molecule? It's absolutely neutral. It's 0. Well, we're going to see that it has some very interesting properties because of this atom right here, namely oxygen. Let me go back and look at some of these slides to see where we go from here. Cursor. Ah, here's a cursor. Let me turn my pointer on so it doesn't disappear. Fantastic. All right, so I think we were around here someplace yesterday. All right, some atoms, namely, we have them down here, oxygen, which we have on the board, nitrogen, phosphorus, and also write in sulfur. And you could write out sulfur, or you could abbreviate it with an S, right? Those atoms really pull in electrons. So they have a tendency to share this electron that they're getting from hydrogen unequally. They're kind of greedy. So it pulls an electron in to the oxygen atom. So the oxygen becomes a little bit negative. All right. And when the electron disappears from this hydrogen right here, guess what the overall charge then is of this area of the water molecule? It becomes a little bit positive. So even though if you look from the back of the room, this water molecule is absolutely neutral in electrical charge. If you are close to it on one end or the other, this end over here looks a little bit positive. This end over here looks a little bit positive. And the oxygen that has grabbed those electrons becomes what? A little bit negative. But if you add this negative charge and these 2 positive charges together, what does that equal? Absolutely 0. They cancel each other out. So because of that, because one end of the water molecule is negative and the other end is positive, we say water is polar. The opposite ends look different in terms of electrical charge. All right, so what about a human person? Are humans polar? You could say yes, and why? Maybe not in terms of electrical charge, but you know what the top of a person looks like because what's up there? Your head is up there, which look a lot different than your feet, right? So the 2 ends of a human, in that sense, look a lot different because the anatomy is quite different. Right and left, it's not really polar. Okay, front and back, certainly polar. but and top and bottom polar. So polar just means that two ends of something are have some kind of different nature associated with them. Okay. So water, even though the overall charge, I've been looking at the PowerPoint slide now, even though the overall charge is absolutely neutral, the ends that have the hydrogen atoms right here are a little bit positive. The end that has the water molecule is a little bit negative. And we're going to look at this a little bit later. Water can actually break apart, right? And it can form two particles. One is going to be an OH, and it's going to take an electron with it, and the other particle is going to be this hydrogen atom right here. And it's going to be missing its electron because where did it go? It went over to this OH group. All right, so these right here are particles that have an electrical charge on them, hence we call these ions. This is a hydrogen ion, right, and here is a hydroxide ion right here. And these things like to actually dissolve in water very easily because what can you tell me about this hydrogen ion right here? It wants to associate in water. What part of the water molecule does it want to associate with very easily? This little negative part, because remember, opposite charges do what? They attract each other. And as a matter of fact, water molecules attract each other because, right, if we put two water molecules together, this end of one water molecule wants to associate with the other end of the neighboring water molecule. So water molecules are almost like a liquid crystal. Even though they're liquid, there's a lot of interaction between water molecules. Okay? And that's due to these polar covalent bonds. And polar covalent bonds are pretty strong. Okay. What else do I want to say about that? Oh, yeah, let's take a look at this hydrogen. So if we just pull a hydrogen from someplace, that's a hydrogen atom, how many protons inside the nucleus? How many protons inside the nucleus of hydrogen? One, okay. So I'm just going to put a positive charge right there. So that's a proton in the nucleus, and then in this first orbital right here, what are you going to find? One electron, right? So here is that one electron. Remember, they cancel each other out. What's the overall charge right here? It's absolutely neutral. Now, for some reason, let's rip away this electron or give it away to somebody else. What do we have left right here? We have a hydrogen that looks like that. We'd abbreviate it like that. So we call that a hydrogen ion because it's charged. But what is this hydrogen ion? What is a subatomic particle that you see right there? It's just a proton. So people use those terms interchangeably. Hydrogen ion and proton, people talk about it exactly the same way because why? They are exactly the same thing, right? So hydrogen ion is equal to a proton. And sometimes, even in the same sentence, I might interchange those two terms. Okay, so that's something you should know about covalent bonds. Electrons are shared. That has to do with sharing of electrons in the valence orbital. What else? The strength of these bonds are very strong. And depending on the element, whether it's oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, or sulfur, these will produce polar bonds that produce funny kinds of molecules like water that have different electrical natures in different part of the molecule. Yeah.
Is that exclusively only
hydrogens or like in other cases of other elements that have positively charged that? Can we further have protons or are they just like their own ions? Yeah, if we, for instance, look at, this thing is gone right here. Let me drag it back over. For instance, maybe like magnesium you're interested in. Let's find magnesium. Where do we have magnesium? 12. Very good, you guys. Ah, here it is right here. All right. If we rip away all the electrons from magnesium, it's going to have a plus 12 charge. Okay. And I suppose we could call that, you know, a 12 proton nucleus, but it gets cumbersome to say that. The only one that's easy to use is hydrogen because it only has one proton in it. If we take all the electrons away from helium, then we would have to say double proton or triple proton for lithium, things like that. The only element that's useful for is hydrogen because it only has one proton in it. Okay. Some of these other things which we're going to look at right now, like sodium and potassium, they can be ions, just like hydrogen ion right here, but it's going to be just a little bit different. They're going to hold some of their electrons, and we're going to see which ones they can hold and which ones they can't right now. Okay? So that might answer your question a little bit. I came close. I don't know. Maybe we need to talk again to see if I really understood your question. Okay. Okay, fantastic. Okay. So what kind of covalent bond is produced here in water? Is it polar or nonpolar? It's polar because polar covalent bonds with hydrogen right here are produced with what kind of atoms? Oxygen. Which ones? Oxygens. What other ones? Phosphorus, nitrogen, and sulfur. These produce interesting biological compounds because they produce these polar covalent bonds. All right, the next kind of bond is an ionic bond. Okay, and this occurs when valence electrons are transferred from one atom to another. So they're no longer being shared. One atom gives up an electron completely, and another atom takes it away completely. They're no longer being shared. Totally different kind of bond. These are weaker bonds than covalent, but not the weakest that you're going to see all over the place. All right? And when an ionic bond is formed, right, it's formed because ions are produced. And let's take a look at this one right here. I don't think I want to write this on the board, but here we have an atom that has 11 protons inside the nucleus. What kind of compound has 11 protons inside the nucleus? That would be a typical kind of test question for chemistry in this class. Easy to do because you get the periodic table. And so where do you want to look? You go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and then here's 11. What is that? What's Na? You got to know what Na stands for. Yeah, that's sodium. Okay, and then you want to fill in the orbitals. Okay, first orbital's got what? 2, the next one's got 8, and then the next one, there are 8 possible, but it only has 1 in the third orbital, right? There's only 1. It doesn't have the full complement of 8. All right, so here is, ooh, I can't leave it there. I got to leave it out here a little bit, just like that. Okay, otherwise I'll have to close PowerPoint down. Okay, so here is an atom with 11 protons inside the nucleus. I don't care about these neutrons, and probably neither should you, but that's just this particular isotope. All right, so let's fill these orbitals. The first one's got 2. The next one has got 8. All right, so that's 10, but there should be, what, 11? So here is an extra electron in the third orbital. And remember, how does this sodium become stable? By filling the outermost orbital completely. And it can't find the 7 electrons someplace. The easiest thing for sodium to do is just to boot this one electron out of the atom, and then its outermost shell has 8 electrons and becomes very stable. So sodium is going to boot this electron out. It's got to find somebody to accept it. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. But when sodium boots this electron out of the last orbital right here, now what becomes of the overall charge of this sodium atom? Okay, yeah, because now you have one extra proton, it has an additional 1 positive charge. All right, so here is a sodium atom with 1 additional positive charge because it's missing this electron. And again, here's how we would write it down. This is what we would call an ion, right? It has electrical charge. Sometimes we might want to call that an electrolyte. And these are very important compounds in your body, even though they're so very simple, because when you have a charge, a positive charge in motion in your body, it becomes a current, an electrical current. So you have electricity, you have voltage because of these charges, you have electrical currents in your body because of these compounds that we call ions or electrolytes. Right? Furthermore, if it has a positive charge, you should know that it's called a cation. And if it's an ion and it ends up being a negative charge, then we call it an anion. So there's a difference between cation and anion, and these things have to match up in your body so that you don't turn into a big generator. All right, so let's talk about how an atom can become an anion. Yeah.
Is the electrolyte just for the positive charge? Nope,
it could be negative as well. Okay. And as a matter of fact, here we're going to see how an important electrolyte in your body has a negative charge, and that is chlorine. So here's a chlorine atom. How many protons inside the nucleus of a chlorine? Look at your periodic table if you have it. If not, I'll put it up over here. And where's chlorine over here? Yeah, there's 17. All right, so there's two in the first orbital. The second orbital is completely filled up with 8. All right, the third orbital has got 17. I mean, well, it's got 7. All right, it's missing one, right, to be filled up. Guess where it's going to get an electron from? Yeah, from sodium, right? So it accepts this electron from sodium, and now it's nice and stable. This outer orbital is completely filled up with electrons, but now there's an imbalance of charge. Something weird happened, okay? Imbalance in charge of this molecule, so it no longer is electrically neutral. It has one extra electron, so we call that, what do we call that? Aha, I bet the light turned colors. It's an anion, which is also an ion, but it's a special kind of ion, and it's also called an electrolyte. Right? It's an important ion in your body that has to do with maintaining the electrical properties of your body and various electrical currents in cells and things like that. Okay, so now you see how ions are formed. Now, furthermore, what can you tell me about opposite charges? See if I can lecture and walk down the stairs at the same time. That's tricky. Then find batteries. No, I can't find batteries. Okay. Can't find batteries. What can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other, right? So now you have a cation and an anion, namely sodium ion and a chloride ion right here. What do? They attract each other, right? So that they are now electrically neutral. And since they're attracting each other because this electron has been transferred, we call that an ionic bond. That's an ionic bond. And ionic bonds are fairly weak. Actually, they're a lot weaker than covalent bonds. As a matter of fact, if you put these compounds together, just sodium and chloride, and let them dry out, they're going to form, and you're familiar with what these things look like, they're going to form what? A nice crystal like this, where you have a chlorine here, and then a sodium, because they attract each other, and then what? Another chlorine, and then a sodium, and then what would you have down here? A chlorine, and then a sodium, and then a chlorine, and so that association will just form over and over and over again, and when you look at salt in a salt shaker, what does it look like? Just like that, but you don't see the little NAs and CLs in there. Okay? Some people do that with trinkets and things like that. I don't know how they do that. And these are weak bonds because what happens if you take that sodium chloride crystal and put it in water even? The bonds, those ionic bonds are so weak that these ionic bonds are going to break and sodium chloride dissolves in water. Just by putting it in water is enough to break that big crystal apart. Okay, now here's the interesting thing. Why does it like to dissolve in water? Because the basic nature of water is polar. It has positive and negative charges associated with it. And of course, these electrolytes have positive and negative charges. So what can you say about opposite charges? They attract each other. So here you have a sodium atom, right? And it's an ion. It's a positive, and you saw how that developed. And here we have a bunch of water molecules. What end of the water molecule wants to associate with sodium right here? The negative end of the water molecule right here, which is the oxygen end. So the oxygen end is going to surround this sodium. That's what we call a hydration sphere. Chloride, on the other hand, likes to dissolve in water just as well because it wants to associate with the positive ends of the water molecule. Remember, water is polar. It has these different natures depending on which end you're looking at. So sodium and chloride dissolve in water very easily. And you could probably infer why lipids do not dissolve in water. Because they don't have any of these electrical charges. They're completely neutral. There's nothing in the lipid molecule, right, that has any electrical charge that wants to associate with one end or the other of a water molecule. So, therefore, they can't dissolve in water. Okay, so don't forget, ionic bonds are weaker than covalent bonds. You don't even have to say polar. It's weaker than any kind of covalent bond. All right, so let's break molecules down into two general classes. We can do this pretty much with any kind of molecule anywhere on the planet. We can say there are some hydrophilic and some hydrophobic molecules. And hydro stands for water, right? A hydrophilic molecule does what to water? Loves water, right? It wants to associate with water because it has electrical charges on it, and opposite electrical charges can attract. And it doesn't matter if you're a cation or an anion, you're still attracted to water. Why is that? This is freaky. Why are you attracted to water irregardless, or regardless if you're a positive particle or a negative particle? Because water has both, right? Depending on what end you're thinking about. Okay. All right, so ions dissolve in water because they readily form hydration spheres, right? And there are a number of molecules that dissolve in water, like glucose. You're familiar with this, right? When you do put sugar in your coffee in the morning, it's loaded with polar covalent bonds, so it can dissolve in water. Amino acids have polar parts to it as well, so they can dissolve in water very nicely. That's one class. That's one whole universe. The other universe of molecules is what? Hydrophobic. Hate water because they have no electrical charges on them. So these molecules are nonpolar, cannot form hydration spheres. They don't want to have anything to do with water whatsoever. Okay. All right, so there's two kinds of bonds. The third kind of bond is even weaker than an ionic bond. And here is an H1H2O. What does that look like? Water. H2O is water. Right, and we know water is a polar compound, so the oxygen is a little bit negative. The hydrogen end over here is a little bit positive. And if we put another water molecule in this container, the hydrogen in the second water molecule wants to associate with the oxygen of the first one that we put in there. And there is this little attraction right here. That's what we call a chemical bond. Again, it's due to the arrangement of valence electrons. But this is an extremely weak kind of bond. So if you have molecules in your body that you want to put together, but you want to rip them apart again at a later time without wasting a lot of time, what kind of bond would you use? Maybe you have a molecule like Velcro where you want to stick it together, pull them apart. But you want to put it back together again. Well, wait a second, changed my mind. I want to take it apart. Easy to do with Velcro. What kind of bond is that the easiest to do so far that we looked at? Hydrogen, because it's the weakest bond. So molecules can be put together, taken apart very easily when we use hydrogen bonds. Hydrogen bonds can form any time you have a covalently bound hydrogen to what element right here? Oxygen. What else? Phosphorus. Okay, phosphorus, sulfur, and nitrogen. What about carbon? No, we didn't mention carbon. Okay, and we're going to take a look at that really, really soon. So we see if we put a whole bunch of water molecules together, like in a little pond or a stream or a lake or an ocean, all those water molecules are kind of sticking together, and the surface, right, acts as a nice barrier because it produces surface tension. There are even some animals that can walk right on the surface of water because these molecules are attracted to each other. Anybody ever see an animal walk right on the surface of water? What am I thinking? I should have a nice internet picture. Like a water spider or insect, right? They're not heavy enough to push these water molecules apart. But of course, if we try to walk on water, that's too bad. We're going to go kaplunk. We're heavy enough. Okay. All right, the fourth kind of chemical bond, which is absolutely the weakest, I'm going to talk about in a little bit later, after we look at some molecules. All right, so I'm going to change topics now and talk about acids, bases, and the pH scale. All right, so don't forget, I wrote over here this thing. All right, what is this entity right here that I wrote on the board? What is that thing? That is a hydrogen ion. It used to be a hydrogen atom, but the electron we took away. So it's a hydrogen ion, but it is also a proton just sitting there on the board. Okay. All right, so let's now consider acids, bases, and the pH scale. Acids are compounds, or actually they're molecules, that can release protons, which is what? A hydrogen ion, into a solution. So acids are proton donors, and it changes the chemical properties of all the molecules in that solution drastically. pH is very important for changing the reactivity of the chemical reactions that can take place within a solution. All right, so if an acid releases protons when we put it into water, what is a base? A base is something that does the opposite. It will absorb protons, or it will bind protons when you put a base into water. So we call it a proton acceptor, or you could say hydrogen ion acceptor if you wanted to. Here are some names of various kinds of acids in your body over here, like hydrochloric acid. It's a strong acid. It completely breaks down. You don't find any hydrochloric molecule, HCl, when you put it in water. It completely dissociates into 100% hydrogen ion and chloride anion. Okay. Here are some a little bit weaker acids, phosphoric acid, nitric, sulfuric, and carbonic. Right. A couple that are important in your body are phosphoric acid. You have a lot of phosphate, as well as carbonic acid. And carbonic acid is going to be really important because you see something that is CO3 right here, which kind of related is related to CO2. And what can you tell me about CO2? Is that an important molecule in your body? Yeah, your body's producing that all the time when mitochondria make ATP. Okay. All right, so we're going to look at that one. Here are some examples of bases in your body, and notice you don't see any protons. You see something that looks like a hydroxide ion right here. Okay, and so this can combine with a proton from an acid. If you take a proton from an acid with this OH from a base, what do you get? You get H2O. So an acid and a base can neutralize each other. All right, so here are some just common kinds of bases. All right, so how do we talk about acidity or alkalinity, which is kind of a concept of how much base is in a solution? So how do we talk about acidity and alkalinity in this? There's a measurement that we call the pH scale, little p, capital H, right? And this is just a symbol for the hydrogen ion, right, or proton concentration inside of a solution, right? This scale goes from 0 to 14. It's a pretty simple scale. You could have equal numbers of protons and hydrogen ions in solution, in which case, what is going to be the pH if you have an equal number of H pluses and OH negatives? Yeah, it's going to be neutral, right? Because they will neutralize each other. That's going to be a pH of 7. And 7 is right smack in the middle between 0 and 14. Okay. Here is the chemical equation that you're going to use to calculate pH. Or if I give you pH, you'll be able to calculate the hydrogen ion concentration in solution right here. You're going to do that in lab, right? Or on your own, or see me during office hours. There's some questions at the end of the chapter for doing this. So pure water that's neutral, neither acidic or basic, has a pH of 7. Acids have a pH number that is less than 7, so between 0 and 6.99 means that it's acid. And bases have a pH between 7 and 14, or 7.01 and 14, means that the solution is basic. And the pH number gets bigger and bigger, it means that it is what? More and more basic. As the pH number goes from 7 to 6 to 5 to 4 to 3 means the solution is becoming more acidic. Now this is a little strange, okay, when you first start thinking about it mathematically, it makes perfect sense when you use this equation right here, okay. But what makes a solution acidic? I want to draw a couple beakers on the board right here. So let's say, come on, marker. Let's get a sense, and you'll have a really good sense of what that pH means in just a little bit. All right, so here it is, a nice beaker. We got some water in there. Here's another beaker with some water. Another beaker with some water. And here is, what's that? That's a hydrogen. What's over here? Another hydrogen ion. And here is a hydroxide ion. Here's another hydroxide ion. Oh, what's this one right here? Hydrogen ion, right? Or a proton. And then here's another hydroxide ion. So what's the pH? You can actually tell me what the pH of this solution is, of water with these protons and hydroxide ions in there. What's the pH of this beaker right here? It's got to be exactly 7 because the concentration of hydrogen ions exactly equals the concentration of hydroxide, right? So that's a pH of 7. Now let's look at this beaker right here. Let's put a hydrogen ion here, hydroxide right there, and then look at that. What's happening to this solution right now? Okay. Is it becoming acidic or basic? Okay, acidic or basic. I'm glad I'm drawing it out. It's becoming more acidic. So we said here, I'm going to actually write this down. This is neutral. Here is acidic because the hydrogen ion concentration is increasing. You can't tell me the pH because I didn't tell you the concentration of these particles right here, but at least you can say it's acidic because you have many more protons in solution than you do hydroxide ions. All right, now here's the strength. So the acidity is doing what? It's going up. But what about, here is the pH number. What about the pH number? This is strange. Okay, here the pH number is what? Less than 7. I can't tell you what it is. You know, it might be 5, might be 4, might be 3. It goes all the way down to 0. Okay, it's going to be less than 7. So, look at my thumbs. As the acidity, right, as the number of protons in solution increases, it becomes more acidic. But what about the pH number? It goes down. So there's an inverse relationship between acidity. As it's going up, the pH number goes down. So your mind has to just kind of wrap around that. Those of you that maybe know a little bit of algebra, what do we have right here? An inverse relationship. Okay, in the chemical equation. So when you work this equation a couple times, that will help you realize the situation. Let's work one more example, just for fun. Here we have our third beaker right here, and we got, what do we got right here? A proton. Okay, and then what do we got? Hydroxide ion. What kind of ion is this? What kind of ion is this? For instance, is this a cation? No, hydroxide is an anion. Okay, I'll have to draw one more little figure for you in a second. Okay, now what can you tell me about this solution right here? Is it acidic or basic? Because the hydrogen ion concentration is very low, hydroxide is really high, so this is a basic. This is a basic solution. Right, this is basic. Now what about the pH number? You can tell me a range. You can't tell me exactly, but you can tell me a range. Where are these pH numbers going to be? These are going to be greater than 7. And that could be maybe an 8 or a 9 or a 10. And what's the most that it can be?
14.
It can be 14. Okay? So don't forget, as a solution becomes more acidic, the pH number goes down the opposite way. So you might want to even just memorize this equation right here. Okay, here is a scale to help you realize that and give you a little feel for this pH number. Okay, if we have 1 times 10 to the minus 7th molar concentration of hydrogen ions, all right, and a 1 times 10 to the minus 7th concentration of hydroxide ions, all right, then this solution has exactly the same number of hydroxide and hydrogen ions in solution. So what is it? It's neutral. And what is the pH number for neutrality? It's 7. So right smack in the middle, that's pH 7. As the concentration increases for hydrogen ions, going from 10 to the minus 7 times 10 to the minus 6, remember this number is getting bigger as that exponent gets bigger. Right? Then we've got 10 to the minus 4, minus 3, minus 2, minus 1, and then here is just 10 to the 0th right here. This is the highest hydrogen ion concentration. This is what? The smallest pH number. The other thing that you probably notice is the number of decimal places that you count over, or the exponent on this 10, corresponds to what? The pH number. All right, so that's why they developed that pH equation. All right, so pH 7 means that it's 10 to the minus 7th molar concentration of hydrogens and 10 to the minus 7th for hydroxide. All right, so pH 14 is what? Really 10 to the minus 14th, a really small number of hydrogen ions, which means what? It is not acidic at all. It's basic. All right, so that's how that works. All right, so on a test, don't get tricked up by that. As the acidity increases, it means what? Hydrogen ions are going up, but what about pH? Going down, right? And you can see it on this graph right here. Okay, a buffer, very important concept. All right, let's just consider blood for a second. pH of your blood, I've forgotten, 7.35. So the pH of your blood is 7.35. How could you describe that to somebody besides that number? What is the acidity of your alkalinity of your blood? 7.35 is a little bit what? A little bit basic, right? It's not acidic because that would be less than 7. All right, so that's a little bit strange, but here's a stranger thing. Right now, your pH, everybody in here is almost exactly 7.35. Let's just say it is. And then all of a sudden, you had a big slurpy Coca-Cola from 7-Eleven, right? And the pH of that solution is pretty close to zero. It might be a pH of 1, which means what? Very acidic. So you're drinking all of this acid in your body. That's going to decrease the pH of your body, okay? And if your blood changed from 7.35 to 7.25, which is just a little change in my mind, that would be enough to kill you. That's amazing that that pH number is so sensitive in terms of controlling the biochemistry inside your body. But have you ever drank a Coca-Cola? Have you ever had a nice vinaigrette dressing, which is acetic acid that you put on the salad? And here you still are, right? You didn't die, even though you ate all that acid. There are things in your body that are called buffers, all right, that maintain the pH of your body. So you don't really have to worry about eating too much acid or eating too much base for that instance. So buffers are molecules that slow changes in pH by either combining or releasing hydrogens. Another way of thinking of this is that a buffer is a chemical compound that prevents a change in pH when you add an acid to a solution or a base. Doesn't matter what you add to a solution, the pH doesn't change. Right? Kind of a corollary to that is that a buffer is not something that maintains neutrality. Right? A buffer doesn't maintain a pH of 7. It maintains whatever pH that its nature is. There are some buffers that maintain a pH of 9. There's some that maintain a pH of 5. Right? Your body has buffers that maintain a pH of, on average, if you average them all together, what? 7.35. Okay, so you can add a base to yourself or an acid, and you shouldn't change very much from 7.35. Here is one important buffer system. Oh, and we talked about this one already. Okay, we call this the bicarbonate buffer system. That's in blood, and it revolves around carbonic acid. So here's carbonic acid, that H2CO3 that we looked at on the previous slide. H2CO3, which is carbonic acid, can break down into water and carbon dioxide. All right, so we can look at this. Well, there's two hydrogens here. What do we got on these molecules over here? Two hydrogens. How many oxygens do we have? You've got one, and then here's two. Add those together, you get three. How many in carbonic acid? Three. Right, so we're not changing the number of elements. We're just rearranging them and making one molecule from H2O and CO2. We call that carbonic acid. And this is an acid because when you put carbonic acid in water, what happens to it? What's the definition of an acid? It releases protons, right? And when you put carbonic acid in water, here's that proton that is released, and then you're left with the bicarbonate ion. Notice it has a charge. And is this an anion or a cation? It's an anion, right? Okay. All right, so notice that these arrows right here are pointing which way? He went this way, right? And it goes both ways. That means that this reaction is freely reversible. It can go to one side or the other. We're going to look at this, the nature of chemical reactions that can go bidirectionally in the next couple chapters, okay? But it's regulated by the concentration of these compounds. If all of a sudden we put a lot of carbon dioxide in solution, it forces the reaction to the right. If we put a lot of bicarbonate in the solution, it forces the reaction to the left. I'll just say it for fun, but you don't have to know it for this chapter, but in a subsequent chapter. We call that Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action. And we'll look at the energetics of why that happens. I think you start looking at things like that in lab this week. Okay, but don't forget the underlying point. What's a buffer? Does it maintain pH 7? No, it maintains the proper pH, right? It just resists changes in pH when either you add an acid or a base to solution because it can eat up protons or release protons to keep the pH the same. All right, so here's blood. Maybe I looked at this slide once before. Normal range, 3.5 to 4.5. That's what's maintained normally through homeostasis. Somebody might be alive with a pH of 7.2, but it would be a condition that develops over a long period of time, okay? Maybe due to diabetes or something like that, Okay, but it's not something that can happen in just a couple minutes and be survivable. All right, so blood is maintained by buffers, mostly that bicarbonate buffer system. Acidosis means your blood is too acidic, means what? Less than 7.35. You could be alkalotic, and that means your pH of your blood is greater than, right, more basic than 7.45. Acidosis versus alkalosis. Those are some terms that you should know about. All right, so that is acids and bases. So don't forget, if something becomes more acidic, what about that pH number? Goes down, because there's an inverse relationship. Organic molecules. Let's talk about some organic molecules. So these are organic molecules. Some organic molecules are important biological compounds. Most organic molecules are not important, or maybe they're actually really harmful to have in our body. So I want you to be aware of what an organic compound is as opposed to an important biological compound. I'm going to talk about some important biological compounds, but first talking about organic molecules. Okay, and organic molecules are those molecules, and remember, a molecule is just some kind of thing that has more than one atom. Right, so a molecule has two atoms joined together, at least two. Could have hundreds, maybe even thousands of atoms joined together. Then that becomes a molecule. So organic molecules are those that contain a carbon covalently bound to a hydrogen. It's got to have both of those elements, and they have to be bound together with a covalent bond. Ah, what's a covalent bond again? I forgot. What's happening to electrons? Ah, they're being shared. Yeah, they're being shared. All right. So what about this molecule right here? What about CO2? Is that an important biological molecule in your body? Yeah, because it participates in the bicarbonate reaction, buffering reaction that we looked at. Your body produces that when it's making ATP. Mitochondria produce that. But is that an organic compound? No, some people saw that. Fantastic. Because what are you missing? I don't see a hydrogen atom bound to it covalently, right? So I want you to appreciate that distinction. Important biological compounds don't have to be organic. Lots of organic compounds are not important biologically, and you should kind of get the sense of that nuance right there. All right, carbon. What can you tell me about carbon? Guess what I got to pull out? I got to get it out over here. Ah, the periodic table. I think what I have for you in Blackboard actually says periodic table right here, not atomic masses, but this is really the periodic table. And where's carbon? Here's carbon right here. What about the first orbital? Completely filled up. Second orbital, it's got 1, 2, 3, 4. That means it needs how many electrons to become stable? It needs 4 to fill that outer orbital up, right? We could draw it on the board, but here is just a tabular form, right, of that. So carbon has 4 electrons in the outer shell. It will bond covalently to fill those 4 outer shells, right, so that it has 8 altogether. I don't know. What's the next slide? All right. Let's take a look at this. Here are some organic molecules, not important biochemically in you, but here is hexane. Hexane has got 6 carbons all covalently bound together, and then it's filled up with hydrogens right here. So we call this a hydrocarbon, right? So here's a kind of hydrocarbon. Is this an organic compound? Absolutely, right? Because you've got carbon covalently bound right here. All right, so this is the general backbone that important biological molecules are made of. Can I erase this beautiful figure right here? All right, so let me just draw really quickly what's happening with that carbon. All right, so, and see if you can actually see this ahead of time. So you got carbon with how many protons inside the nucleus? Oh, I hid the periodic table. Anybody remember? It's got 6, right? So here's a nucleus with those 6. So the first orbital is filled up with 2. That means the valence orbital has got 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. All right, it needs how many electrons to become stable? 4. Where is a really simple atom that it could get 1 electron from? Hydrogen. So we could put a hydrogen here with its electron. We could put a hydrogen here, okay, with its electron here, and then the same for here. Oops. All right, and here, like that. And so now electrically, this compound is completely neutral. All the electrons cancel out the protons. All the orbitals are filled properly. Okay, and is this a polar molecule or not? What are the atoms, when bound to hydrogen, right, suck electrons into this central atom right here and produce a polar compound? I got four. Is carbon one of them? It's not. It's oxygen, it's sulfur, it's phosphorus, and nitrogen, not carbon. So carbon doesn't produce polar bonds, so this compound right here is nonpolar. No matter how far away, how close, what end of the molecule you look at, it looks exactly the same electrically. Will this molecule like to dissolve in water because it's nonpolar? Absolutely not, because it has no electrical charge that wants to associate with a water molecule. So this right here, anybody know the name of this compound? Okay, this is methane, CH4. Not important biologically. Well, it sort of is. When you end up with in clinical practice sometime, you'll have to take continuing medical education units, right, to keep your certification valid. Always go and listen to the gastroenterologists. Okay, you can go listen to brain surgeons, they'll put you to sleep, right, and anybody else, but the gastroenterologists you want to go listen to, what do these people do? They deal with your digestive tract, and that causes huge problems for people, so clinically it's very important, but since these people are dealing with these really unseemly items all day long, okay, they have a really good sense of humor. They're wonderful to listen to. And one of the things that's important, one molecule that's really important in gastroenterology is what? Methane. When somebody has malabsorption syndrome and they're excreting this gas in terms of flatulence. Right, so you should go listen to these people. They're fantastic. So under certain circumstances, you can consider this molecule important biologically, but typically it's not unless something is really kind of going wrong inside somebody's body. Somebody had a question. Yeah. That's right. For this class, those are the only four you have to know. And those are the only ones I'm familiar with. There might be some others out there. I'd maybe have to look at the periodic table and I might see a pattern right there, but those are the only ones. Okay, so what about hexane right here? Hexane is just what? An expansion of this methane model right here. So is hexane polar or nonpolar? Nonpolar. Okay, all the orbitals are filled up. Hydrocarbons, long hydrocarbons, have a tendency to fold back on each other and form cyclic rings, cyclic structures. So instead of hexane, simple hexane, this right here is what? Cyclohexane. And this molecule can even be more stable if it gets rid of some of these hydrogen atoms right here, and then certain really fascinating kinds of double bonds can form between carbon atoms. If you want to see how that develops, maybe you see me during office hours, and these things, these double bonds can flip from here to here, and resonance forms, and so benzene is even more stable as a result than cyclohexane, but that goes way beyond what you need to know in this class. All right, but what you do want to know in this class, what do you see bound to every carbon atom, like in this top row right here? Hydrogen, okay? There can be other things that bind to these carbon atoms, other kinds of elements. We call those things functional groups. We might want to put a phosphate group right here, or an oxygen, or a sulfur, or something like that. And then we're changing the structure of this molecule. But since this is a physiology class, tell me, what does that really mean? If we're changing the structure of this molecule by substituting other functional groups for this hydrogen right here. We're changing the function. We're changing what this molecule can do, right? So that's how I want you to look at this next group of molecules that we're looking at. Okay, so let's look at some functional groups. Here is a carbonyl group. So instead of two hydrogens, you have a double bond to an oxygen. And here, instead of a hydrogen, one hydrogen, we have, what, a hydroxide group. Right? So this is a different kind of functional group. It's called a hydroxyl group. And then here is a sulfur. Ooh, what does that sulfur do? It makes polar covalent bonds, right? So it helps make this molecule a little bit more soluble in water, right? But it's, we're going to see it does some other things. Right? So here's a sulfhydro group. Here's an amino group. Amino group has a nitrogen to it. All right, and then if on the end, instead of hydrogens, instead of three hydrogens, we substitute a double bond to an oxygen and then to a hydroxyl group right here, this is what we call a carboxyl group. Now, carboxyl group is very important because this last hydrogen right here likes to jump off. All right, and what do we call a compound that donates protons to a solution? That's an acid. So this carboxyl group is an acidic group. All right, so we call sometimes this a carboxylic acid, carboxyl group. And then here we have a phosphate group. So sometimes these substitutions can produce alcohols, like in terms of this OH right here, right? Aldehydes and ketones if there's a double bond, or organic acids, for instance, if it's a carboxyl group or even a phosphate, these protons can jump off into solution as well, and that makes this like a phosphoric acid group, a phosphate acid group. All right, so these substitutions drastically change how these molecules work inside our body. All right, so you do have to know that this is a carbonyl group. This is a hydroxyl group. I have some exercises in Blackboard, and maybe next time on Thursday we'll look at a flash quiz. All right, just a fun little quiz that we just do as a group in class to help remember what some of these different functional groups are. But remember, when you change the structure of something, what are you changing? You're changing the function of these molecules. And I can't tell you all the changes in function because you just can't learn everything all at one time. Okay. All right, so now let's turn our attention to important biological molecules. We've got four kinds of important biological molecules. All right, the first one is carbohydrate. All right, carbs. Second one is protein. The third one will be lipid. And then the fourth one, anybody know what this fourth one is? Really important, but if you haven't looked at all the molecules in your body, it will be nucleic acids.
Yeah.
Nucleic acids. All right, so these are all organic compounds, but they're also important biologically for us. You have to know what the building blocks are of each of these compounds. Before you took this class, I'm sure you know what a building block of a protein is. It is what? Amino acid. Building block. And guess what? If we go back to that previous slide, you know some of the components that make an amino acid already. Ooh, let's go back. What does it have? It has an amino group. It's got an NH2 right here. It's got an acid group, namely this carboxyl group that makes, if we put these things together on something that has a carbon, that makes it an amino acid. All right, so amino acids make proteins. What makes a carbohydrate? What are the building blocks of a carbohydrate? We're going to say, you're close. Yeah, those are the elements that make it up. We're going to say a simple sugar. You could say simple sugar or a mono meaning what? One saccharide. A monosaccharide. And a good example of a monosaccharide would be glucose. And if we put a glucose, bind it to another glucose, we get a disaccharide. And if we put a third glucose on there, we get a trisaccharide. And if we put thousands of glucoses together, we get a polysaccharide. But these polysaccharides that are made up of glucose have specific names, like starch. Okay? And that's what we find in plants. A similar kind of compound that we have in our bodies is called glycogen. All right, so the building block of glycogen is glucose. The building block of starch is, what's a building block of starch? Is glucose, right? It's just purely glucose all joined together. So somebody that has trouble regulating their blood glucose concentration, what kind of disease process is that called? Diabetes mellitus. All right, somebody with diabetes mellitus, can they eat whatever kind of starch they want anytime? No, because what is it really like? It's just like eating candy. It's just made up of sugar. It doesn't taste sweet, but it's just basically sugar. All right, so building block of a carbohydrate or a polysaccharide is a monosaccharide. Building block of a protein is amino acid. Building block of lipids, we're going to see there are two right there. There are fatty acids. All right, and glycerol. All right, so I want you to know glycerol when we get to it. And the building block for nucleic acids are nucleotides. And we only got like five different kinds of nucleotides. We've got two kinds of nucleic acids in your body. Two kinds of nucleic acids. There's DNA and RNA. We're going to look at those two different kinds. They're both made up of nucleotides. There's only five kinds of nucleotides, 20 different kinds of amino acids, various monosaccharides, a few important fatty acids. You're going to become familiar with some of these, but not all of them. All right, so the first group that we're going to look at is carbohydrates. Okay, so here is that nice long hydrocarbon backbone, and it's an organic compound, of course, right? But it's not like hexane because, look, you have different functional groups added or substituted for those hydrogens. You have a hydroxyl group, right? You've got a carbonyl group right here, right? So that changes the property. Now, what kind of bond is formed between this oxygen and hydrogen right here? That's a nice covalent bond, but what kind of covalent bond? What forms polar covalent bonds? Oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur. And what's this right here? It is oxygen. So this is a nice polar covalent bond. So what does that mean in terms of water solubility of this molecule right here? It can dissolve in water because it's a polar compound, because of these polar covalent bonds. Here's an example of what glucose looks like. Here's an example of galactose. Both of them have six carbons. The only difference is that the hydroxide group is on different sides of the molecule. You don't have to know definition, but if you look at this cyclic ring right here, you should have a sense that this is a simple sugar when you see this symbol right here, right? And it's got six sides to it. It means that this glucose has just formed a nice cyclic ring. Galactose does the same thing. Here's another one, fructose, a little bit different structure. Its function is a little bit different in your body. Okay, so what I want you to know from this slide is, what is glucose? It is a monosaccharide or simple sugar. Fantastic. And what about fructose? A different kind of monosaccharide because the conformation is a little bit different right here, or how it's put together is a little bit different. All right, so why are these things called carbohydrates? If you look for every carbon, on every carbon atom, what do you have? One hydrogen, two hydrogens, and an oxygen. What is that? H2O, that's water. So this is what we call a carbohydrate, way too wordy, so it is called a carbohydrate. So when these molecules were first analyzed, for every carbon atom, they found what? An H2O, carbohydrate. Okay. These things can be put together. You can put a monosaccharide, join it with a galactose. You can put a glucose and a galactose together. And what do you get? You get a disaccharide. And if you put all three of these things together, you get a trisaccharide. All right, so here is this. Oh, that's what this slide shows, right? Disaccharides are two monosaccharides joined together covalently. Let's look and see how, you might want to know what sucrose and lactose and maltose are. Lactose is one glucose and one galactose, but you don't have to memorize the structure of glucose or the structure of lactose. Just know how these are put together. And maltose is purely two glucoses. And I think that's kind of important because when glycogen is broken down in your body, can glycogen be broken down into sucrose? No, because glycogen is purely what? It's purely glucose. There's no fructose in there. There's no galactose in there. It's only glucose. So when glycogen gets broken down or starch is broken down in your body, it gets broken down into maltose. It's a breakdown product first. Okay. Here's a little discussion of starch and glycogen. These are important storage molecules because mitochondria love to make ATP from glucose. It's a very easy substrate. Right, and it can get glucose from starch or glycogen, and these are polysaccharides. And it's a nice way for your body to just have some simple bookkeeping in terms of some pressures inside your body. Instead of having millions of molecules of glucose running around, which will change the pressure properties inside your cells, it can combine these millions of molecules of glucose into just one account, just one folder. Right, and that makes changing your controlling pressure inside your body a lot easier if you only have one molecule as opposed to millions of molecules running around. We're going to look at that probably maybe for the first exam. It's called osmotic pressure. All right, now here is an important scheme. Here's how your body makes a disaccharide maltose from two glucose molecules. These are brought together, right, and you got all these hydrogen and hydroxyl groups. It can take a hydrogen from one glucose and an OH from another. Put those two together. What do you get when you put this hydrogen and OH together? You get a water molecule. So that pops off, goes into solution. Here it is over here. And now you have a covalent bond formed between these two glucose molecules, and you have a disaccharide. This right here, since we're pulling water out, is a dehydration synthesis reaction. We're synthesizing maltose by pulling water out. Sometimes we call that a condensation reaction, right? Dehydration synthesis. The opposite can occur as well. All right, if your body wants to break this maltose down into two glucose for metabolism of glucose, it can what? It can add water in, right, and it breaks the maltose apart into two glucose molecules right here. So that would be, this actually, you should have a double arrow right here. Going from left to right is dehydration synthesis. Going from right to left, which is breaking maltose down, that is called a hydrolysis reaction. Hydrolysis, and I think I have that on the next slide right here. So water is not only just the solvent that your body is dissolved in, but it participates in many chemical reactions in your body, like what? Hydrolysis reactions or dehydration synthesis reactions. And it's just two ways on the same street. So I want you to be familiar with this dehydration versus hydrolysis reaction. And that is actually your extra credit quiz today or this week in lab to understand something about these dehydration or hydrolysis reactions. So it's just a way of making a polymer, something really complicated out of something that's really, really simple. Aha, but I'm not done yet. Hold on. Don't make too much noise. I don't want you to disturb your neighbor right there. All right, so you can take a glucose and a fructose, put it together to make a sucrose via what kind of reaction? Dehydration. You can take sucrose and break it down into glucose and fructose using a hydrolysis reaction. Okay, and again, water participates. Next compound, lipid. All right, lipids are insoluble in water, so we call these hydrophobic. Oh, what about these compounds over here we just got done talking about? Are they hydrophilic or hydrophobic? They're hydrophilic, and why? Because we got all these polar covalent bonds right here, right? Even though I don't see a charge, there's little charges right there that like to associate with water, right? So don't forget about that, right? So they consist primarily of just pure hydrocarbon chains. If it's a pure hydrocarbon chain or ring, then indeed it is purely hydrophobic because it has no electrical charges. This thing right here is a long hydrocarbon chain, but we see one substitution, and maybe you can remember that this is what? A carboxyl group. And it's acidic because this hydrogen likes to come off of it. All right? If we put, and this is called a fatty acid. Why is this an acid? Because of the carboxyl group right here. And it's fatty because of this long hydrocarbon chain. All right? Some enzymes will look for glycerol. Here's a glycerol molecule. You see it has three carbons, and on each carbon there's one hydroxyl group. Right, and if we put a fatty acid next to it, guess what you can pull off of these two molecules? A water molecule. And now you have a nice covalent bond of a fatty acid to a glycerol, and you can do that three times on this glycerol because it has three OH groups, and now you have something that's called a triglyceride. I'm sure many of you have had your blood measured for triglycerides because that's an important fat that's in your body. Okay, so now you know what the building block of a triglyceride is. It is what? Three fatty acids and glycerol, the chemical reaction that produces it. Your body didn't have to reinvent again because it had already invented it for carbohydrates, and we call this what? A condensation or dehydration synthesis reaction. And of course, if your body needs fatty acids from a triglyceride, how can it get it? With a hydrolysis reaction by using three waters to knock off these three fatty acids, and then you end up with these three fatty acids and one glycerol molecule right here. So that's one important lipid. We're going to start here next time. All right, now the sign-in sheet is going around. Don't forget. Oh, here's somebody's recorder right here. Don't forget that if you don't sign the sign-in sheet, you're absent in lecture. and lab.